in sections four, five, and six in the paper 0209079. Okay, any questions? So again, the students taking the course, and some have already done it, should talk to me about projects. And also, probably you don't want me to announce this, but I will anyway, which is, just in case not everybody knows it, there are chances for undergraduates to do research here at Perimeter and over the summer. And if you're interested, look at the webpage and apply very soon. Okay. Okay, so last time we started to talk about Trent Simon's theory. And so let me just start again to refresh everybody. So we start with the three manifolds, which I'll assume is compact. And so we're calling that sigma. Actually, no, we're not. We're calling that M. And on it, we have a gauge field A, which is valued in some Lie algebra or group, which I'll call G, which the first example will be SU2. But it won't always be SU2. And I'll indicate, most of what I'll have to say is general, and I'll indicate where I use SU2 or some other group specifically. And the idea is that we want to define a field theory which has no structure other than this gauge field. So we have the A and we have the F, which is dA. Let's A wedge A, and let me, this has an internal index I, JK, FI, JK, and this is the general form where F are the structure constants. So let me just say, because I might as well say it now, if we have a general Lie algebra, we have some generators, say tau, I, and let me use capitals for that, because that's what I've been using. Oops. I, J, K. And the generators have an algebra tau I, tau j is some structure constants, F, I, J, K, tau k. And then the AA lives in the Lie algebra, and it can be expanded as like this in terms of the structure, in terms of the generators. Okay. So that's the basic ingredients. We want to make a field theory with only these ingredients. So we want an action which is gauge invariant and makes sense. So therefore, it's some integral of some three form. And we want it to be gauge invariant. And there are not many possibilities for this. And the one that we choose is the integral of a particular three form I introduced last time, called the Trent-Simons form, where the three form can be written as A wedge dA, traced in the Lie algebra variables, plus 2/3 F I JK, JK AI wedge AJ wedge AK. Okay, and that's called the Chern-Simons three form, after Chern and Simons. And it's a remarkable object which plays a fundamental role in physics and in mathematics in a number of different places, from real condensed matter physics to quantum gravity to string theory, etc. So it's certainly worth getting to know it. We talked before about the abelian version, which was just the A wedge dA. This is the non-abelian extension. Okay. And so let me just mention some properties of this, which are worth checking. There are two basic properties. One of them is if we look at the field equations, so we take the variational principle with respect to A, then the field equations give us epsilon ABC FPCI equals zero. So the field equations tell us that the field strengths are equal to zero. And as I said last time, also in the non-abelian case. That's the beautiful thing. And notice, I mean, this is not equal to A wedge F. Right? And the reason it's not equal to A wedge F is if I took the variation of A wedge F, I would take the variation by A and I get F. But then in the variation of F, I have to take the variation. Okay? And there are other terms in here. So this is not equal to A wedge F. It's equal to A wedge F. I don't remember exactly. I think it's minus a third, the FIJK, but somebody can correct me on that. AI wedge AJ wedge AK. So there's an exact amount of this A wedge A wedge A term, which is added, whose variation gives you something in A wedge A, which cancels something that comes. You see, in here, there is already, from the F is dA plus A wedge A, there's already an A wedge A term in here. And you take the variation, you get an A wedge A term. Okay. But because you already took the variation by this A here, another way to say it is because there are three A's, so there's a factor of three, where there's only two A's in the linear term. If you just varied A wedge F, you wouldn't get F. So you have to add this correction term, and then it works out. Don't trust me for this factor here. That's by memory. But this, if you like, is the defining condition of the Chern-Simons invariant. Okay. Another important property, which is remarkable, is that, look, Y by itself isn't gauge invariant. And let me just consider what we call a small gauge transformation. So a small gauge transformation is one where you vary A, and it's the covariant derivative of some function valued in the Lie algebra. So under a small gauge transformation, okay, A varies like this. F varies, we already figured out, but I'll write it again. F varies like epsilon ijk lambda j, and I don't again remember the sign here, FAB. Okay, so F varies homogeneously. Okay. Y doesn't do anything simple, but the wonderful thing, which I think I'm going to ask you to check, is that the variation of Y is not zero, but it's d of some 2 form. And this is something you should check. By the way, when I say these, check these things, nobody ever comes back to me, which is a bad sign, and says, I tried to check this and I ran into this problem. Please do try to check them, and please do come back to me when you run into a problem. Okay? This is a very nice thing to check. It's It's easy to do for the abelian case. For the non-abelian case, it's a bit tricky. Yes?
I have two questions. So doesn't that mean that the action is a full divergence?
So this, that the action.
We like the thing you put inside.
No.
It does.
This is not equal to D of something, but its variation under gauge transformations is.
And something else. So what you're saying, that Z is actually a dual of F, right? That's what comes out what goes in
there. Yes, if you like, this is the dual. So
it's which is equivalent in this case or not?
Yes. Yes.
Not in general.
Oh, in general, yes. Because the dual relates, this is the anti-symmetric symbol.
No, I mean more dimensions you wouldn't be this kind of.
Sure it would. If you're in D dimensions and I have some N tensor, A1 to AN, and I'm in D dimensions where D is more than that, and I take epsilon A1 to AN and say B1 to B up to D minus N, and that gives me an object that always has the same equivalent information in it, just rearranged differently. Okay. So I didn't say the important thing, which is what this means is that the variation of the integral of the transinus invariant is zero. So it's a very interesting object because the integral over the whole manifold is gauge invariant, but not the integrand. So we haven't run into something like this before. And this has very nice consequences. Okay. Well, there's another property which is harder to check, but I'm going to tell it to you. It's not that hard, but it's not quite so elementary. Just to give you a flavor of something else which is important. Let me specify now SU2. And let me specify that our manifold is the free sphere. And let me tell you, and this is something you can look up or check if you don't know it, that as a manifold, the group SU2, as a manifold, is the same thing as the free sphere. As you take all the points in the group SU2, they make topologically a three sphere. Now, I talked, I think, last time about large gauge transformations. So this is where you have a group which is a function of the points of the manifold. And under this gauge transformation, the one form A goes to G inverse D plus A G, which is an exponential form of the gauge transformation. Okay. Now, a gauge transformation is a mapping from the manifold to the gauge group. So if the manifold M is here and the gauge group G is here, for every point in the manifold, you pick a point in the group, and that's how you parameterize a gauge transformation. So in our case, it's a mapping from the three sphere to the three sphere. Now, a mapping from a sphere to a sphere can have a winding number. Just like if you map from a circle to a circle, you can map all the way around a certain number of times. So there's a winding number W, which is the winding number of the map. Okay? Now, the integral of Y is invariant under a small gauge transformation. This is a gauge transformation near to the identity. So it has an infinitesimal form everywhere. Okay. But under a large gauge transformation, there could be a winding number connected with how you move around in the S3, which is the group, as you move around the S3, which is the manifold. And it turns out that under this, the Chern-Simons invariant is not invariant. It gets corrected by a term which is 8 pi squared times the winding number. I hope I have that coefficient right, people who know this?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any relation between statons?
Yes. 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 And so I won't try to show this to you, but this is a very beautiful relationship. And this will play a big role in things that are coming. Okay, so this is the third property.
So is this pi 3 coming in instead of pi 1?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, this is pi 3 coming in. Yeah. Okay. Now, I could give a whole course on the Chern-Simons invariant and its implications in physics and mathematics, and I'm not going to do that. But I'm going to be, it's going to play a major role from time to time. So I'm going to mention some of the properties and postpone some of them. Let me just mention that the study of Chern-Simons theory as a quantum field theory was introduced by Atiyah and Witten in about 1988 in a very beautiful conjecture. Atiyah, who of course is one of the great mathematicians of our time, conjectured that it would be very closely related as a quantum field theory to problems in topology, and particularly to making invariants for three manifolds and for structures like knots and graphs in three manifolds. And an important reason for that is, first of all, it doesn't depend on any background structure. And the second one is that there's a property it has, which I haven't mentioned, which is obvious, which is that it has odd parity. So maybe I'll mention that as odd parity. So under some parity transformation, say some set of coordinates x, take x goes to minus x, so a goes to minus a, being related to derivatives, because it's a covariant derivative, and under that integral y goes to minus integral y. And so even though the field equation is just f equals zero, there's an oddness under parity of the action. And it turns out that can be used to measure invariants, topological invariants, which are also odd parity. And an interesting feature of three-manifold topology is that there are many interesting things that have odd parity. For example, there are many knots. Generically, knots have odd parity. Typically, a knot is not diffeomorphic to its parity inverse. So for this reason, Atiyah conjectured that this quantum field, that if you made a quantum field theory from this, treating it as an action, it would play an important role in topology. And Witten very quickly, in fact, within the same week of the conference where the conjecture was announced, found a demonstration that a certain very important invariant of knots was related to this quantum field theory. And later, that's been reshown by a number of different methods and is now a very fundamental part of topology.
So what do you mean by diffeomorphism? I mean, you have the knot and you make the parity.
Yes.
I mean, that is a diffeomorphism. It's a discontinuous one, though.
That's yes.
So, but there's no continuous.
There's no diffeomorphism related to the identity. And that's true of the simplest knot, which I'm going to embarrass myself trying to draw. That's the simplest knot, which is a trefoil. And its parity invariant can be gotten by just reversing the crossings. Okay, so this is the left trefoil and this is the right trefoil. And they are, you can see that one is related to the other by switching the crossings. And you can show that there is no diffeomorphism connected to the identity, say in the three sphere or in R3 that will take this to this. And it was a long-standing problem in knot theory to give an invariant of knots that gave a different value for these two. And that was solved in terms of it. And as was so.
So this theory is not invariant under diffeomorphism not connected to the identity. It's only invariant under diffeomorphism.
Yes.
Okay.
The field equations are, but the value of the action is not.
I meant to ask you before, so how does this affect the quantum theory then?
It affects the quantum theory.
Because you have the finite path, and of course you have the action there, which then changes the sign.
Yes, so if people don't mind me getting a little bit out of turn, I'll state the conjecture of the TIA and the result. So supposing I jump ahead and I define this quantum field theory. And let me call this the Chern-Simons action. Okay? And let me imagine constructing the expectation value. I defined a Wilson loop. So I'm going to use it as an operator and take its expectation value. And I'm going to define that as the integral under some measure to be specified, e to the I, the Chern-Simons action, a coupling constant k over 2 pi, times the Wilson loop as a function of gamma and a. Okay. So this, we do not have the technology to define and compute, and it's fairly intricate. But it's something that, if there's interest, I can cover. It is closely related to quantum gravity, as we'll see, in both 2 plus 1 and 3 plus 1. And so the discovery of Witten, the conjecture of, I don't know how specifically Atiyah's conjecture was, but the discovery is that this is equal to, up to some factor that I'm not going to tell you about, something called the Kaufman invariant of the knot, which around the same time Lou Kaufman had given a combinatorial procedure to calculate. And indeed, it distinguishes this from this. This is some function of k and the topology of the, so the idea is you take the Wilson loop of the knot and it actually measures the topology of the knot.
So in this theory you have then handedness as an absolute structure.
Yes.
In general theory it does not.
General relativity, we'll come to that. Classical general relativity does not. Okay. But this theory does not as a classical theory either. Because the field equation is just f equals 0, which is certainly even. So it's subtlety. The fact that this can distinguish this from this is definitely a subtlety of the quantum level.
Because it's in the action, you say, solving the field equations?
Yes, yes, yes. Okay. Okay, so what I want to do next, and let me see, yeah, I think I can just do it here, is just really for future use, because I'm not going to dwell more on this right now, just mention the basic results of the Hamiltonian description. And since we've already studied two similar theories, which are abelian transignments and BF theory, I hope it's plausible, but I'll just sketch out the basic results. So now I want to take the manifold to be of the form of some two manifold, which is compact cross time, cross R. So I'm making a different choice, where sigma is compact. And so I have some time coordinate on running along the R direction. And then I can take the action and decompose on an integral dt and an integral d2, say, y in the manifold sigma. So I have some, and sigma might be some interesting two manifold with non-trivial topology. And then the action, and this looks very much like things we've talked about. So again, the coordinates A, which go like 0, 1, 2, go like 0, I for 1, 2. We have an epsilon ij. And we have terms that look like ai del 0 aj epsilon ij. And in fact, with the covariant derivative here, we have terms that look like a0 fij. And then we have terms that look like, and I don't need the coefficient here, which is good because I don't remember it, a0 wedge ai with aj, like that. Okay, that turns out to be a useful way to write it. Actually, let me just write it this way, just with the ordinary time derivative. Okay. Then, since the time derivative is here, it's just like the abelian transignment. In the abelian transignment theory, we just had this. Okay. And this tells us that ai is canonically conjugate to aj. So again, when we develop the momenta, pi I, which is delta s delta a dot spatial I, is epsilon I j a j, sorry, a j I. So this tells us, and I'll just, that again, just like the abelian case, ai at y, aj, say, at z on the two manifold is epsilon ij delta in the group indices delta 2 xy. There's a pi 0, as usual, is equal to 0 because there's no time derivative on a0. And that tells us that we get another constraint, ci, which is f12 I equals 0. So we get three constraints. And then, and that's it. That's the Hamiltonian, when you work it out, is just the integral of some Lagrange multipliers, lambda I, times these constraints, ci. Yes?
Is there some conclusion with the indices on the FJK,
You're right. You're totally right. Thank you.
lowercase in this case and the uppercase in the short context.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm not really, I should, since I really put the epsilon there, I don't need to put the wedge. So it's AI0, AJI, AK, little j, like that. Thank you.
And you see there's a coefficient there, but you don't care.
Yes.
So what is the, what is the other I index of the j?
This index here, this is the Lie algebra index.
Oh, is that correct?
Yeah, so this. Okay. Yeah.
I suppose people assume that it's this side, but I mean, now you're considering a non compact value. Earlier you assumed that it was compact, so the boundary term for the main variation could have managed automatically. So maybe you're assuming some field profiles so that the boundary terms.
Very good, yes, very good. So I'm doing the variation in such a way the delta I, delta A, at the boundaries, so let me just call it the boundaries del M are zero. So I hold the variation fixed at the initial and the final. Thank you. Yeah, otherwise, there are boundary terms. And the boundary terms are very interesting, as you know. I mean, they give, for people who don't know, the boundary terms are related to a type of conformal field theory called Wessing-Witten theory, but I'm not going to need that for the time being. Okay, so this is the basic structure of Chern-Simons theory. And we could go on and discuss observables as we did before. The observables are related to Wilson loops, but I don't want to do, we've done already that in several theories, so I don't want to go on with that at the moment. Okay? Okay, question? Okay. So we've done this. And I want to go back to BF theory for a moment. And for a moment, I want to go four dimensions. And so we discussed before BF theory in three dimensions. So let me tell you what I mean. So I'm now on four dimensions. I now have a manifold M. This is going to be of the form of some three-dimensional manifold cross R, where sigma 3 is going to be compact without boundary to start with. And on this, I have again a gauge connection. I have a gauge field in a group G, which I'll take most of the time to be SU2 when I need to specify it. So therefore, I have, again, an F. Now we're changing gears a little bit. So A is 0, 1, 2, 3. I hope this doesn't flip anybody out. And we're now going to call indices like I, little I, J, K, 1, 2, 3. If otherwise, it's the same setup. We have F as before. But we're also going to have another field, which is a two-form B. So this is a two-form also valued in the Lie algebra, which I'll take for most cases to be SU2. Okay. So now I have the Yang-Mills field, and I have a B field. And now I write an action. And this should be now an integral over a four form. And if I want it to be polynomial and gauge invariant, what are my options? Okay, well, So now we have a two-form F, which is gauged covariant. B is valued in G, and I didn't tell you how B transforms under gauge transformation. So B transforms just opposite the way that F transforms. So minus structure constant IJK, lambda J. This is here. There I have the transformation rules for A and F. B, K, AB, AB, let me move the index K down. So B transforms like, homogeneously like a vector, like F under gauge transformations. Okay. Therefore, if I trace B against F, tracing in the algebra indices, that's a four-form, and it's invariant under the local gauge transformations. So that's one possible term. Anybody see other terms? Yes, okay, so we can have a term F wedge F. Anything else? B wedge B. So I can have a term B wedge B. Okay? And that's all that I can have, which are four forms which are invariant in polynomial. Now, when I say polynomial, I'm excluding, you can make things by taking determinants, inverses, and so forth, but this is all you can do that's polynomial. Okay. And this has some coefficient we'll call alpha. This has a coefficient I'll call lambda over 2. Okay. So that's the action that I'm going to be interested in. And for the time being, I'm going to neglect this term. Okay, but probably not in today's class, but I will come back to the effect of that term. Okay. So let's look at the field equations. Field equations, if I vary V, so V is a two-form, if I vary it, okay, I get F, okay, minus lambda B is equal to 0. So those are some of the field equations. And if I vary by F, by the A, F is a function of A, if I vary the action by A, okay, so we did this several, it's the same thing as we did in 2 plus 1. There's a derivative of A term here, and there's an A term. I vary by the derivative of A, the derivative has to integrate by parts and go around to the D, and then the other one has to make that derivative into a covariant derivative. So this looks like D B plus A wedge B equals to 0. And that is often called just the covariant D wedge B is equal to 0. And notice these are two-form equations and these are three-form, because B is a two-form and D wedge is a three-form. So those are the field equations.
So the B doesn't come from a potential, let's just say.
Right. That's the difference. The B does not come from a potential. Okay. And because there's an integration by parts here, if there was a boundary, there would be boundary terms. And I'm going to come back and talk about those boundary terms. But for the moment, there are no boundary terms because it's compact. The spatial manifold is compact with boundary with no boundary. And the time boundaries, I'm taking the same point of view, the delta B, the delta A and delta B, I don't vary on those boundaries. Okay? Okay, any questions? Yeah.
If you compare the potentials varying from boundaries, and if you solve this theory, you get instant time solutions, solid constitutions.
Well, that's a very, it's a very interesting question, what solutions you get. And
sorry, what was the question?
Do you get something like instant time solutions for this? And we'll, yes, we'll talk about that. We're going to mention some solutions. Okay. Notice something, which is that the equations of motion are compatible because it's true as an identity that d wedge f is equal to 0. This is a Bianchi identity. This is true just by writing things out. There's no content in it. So therefore, this plus this implies dB is equal to 0. So there's a consistency amongst the equations of motion, okay, which is important. Let's see. Yikes. Okay, so this was just a little interruption here, trying to can I erase it?
Rather than consistency, because you don't need that.
Right. If you like, there's a redundancy, yeah. But I mean, it's very important to check that your equations of motion, it might be that your equations of motion together were inconsistent and there were no solutions. So, and this doesn't yet prove that there are solutions, but it helps.
So it's a bit like homogeneous Maxwell equations. They don't result from an action principle. It's just a consistency condition.
Right, but this results from an action principle.
Well, the DF doesn't.
Oh, yes, no, sure, it doesn't. Sure. Okay. Is everybody bored with finding the Hamiltonians and stuff in the momentum? Because we need to do it one more time. This is almost the last time. We need to do it for this time. And then the reason I'm doing this is because this is a setup for what we need to do in general relativity. Okay. Plus, this theory has two wonderful relations to this Chern-Simon theory, and I want to demonstrate them in this theory, which I will as soon as I write down the Hamiltonian stuff. So let's do again the Hamiltonian. And since we've done it three or four times before, I'll just tell you how it goes. So I can use the same picture here, only now this is a three-manifold, the manifold that is the spatial manifold. The action looks like integral dt, integral on sigma b3x. So it starts, and it starts from, there's an epsilon 0 ijk, which is just an epsilon ijk. Okay, right? Epsilon 0 ijk for the four-index symbol is the same thing as epsilon ijk, because the ijk have to be different from 0 and different from each other. And we start off bij times f0k, and f0k starts off del 0 ak, minus covariant derivative of zero, dk a zero. Then there's the term b zero I f j k. Then there's a term b zero I b j k times lambda over two. And I'm ignoring the f wedge f. So that's what there is. no minus sign the way that I have it.
Is the sign from here to
you're right. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So for the momenta, again, I have a b pi I, which is the momenta to the a dot I, and that is equal to epsilon I j k b j k. And there's the internal Yang-Mills index there. And all the other momenta are 0. Pi 0 is 0. And if there are momenta, I'll call them p. For the time derivatives of the b, they're all 0, each and every one of them, because there's no time derivatives on the b whatsoever. Okay. Now, so the spatial part of the b's, the bjk's, the spatial part of the b's are the momenta conjugate to the a's. So again, the Poisson brackets, you can eliminate the spatial part of the b's in terms of the pi's. Okay? And I'll do that because there, for every gauge index I, there are three of these. I equals 1, 2, 3, or three of these because it's an anti-symmetric matrix in three dimensions. So I'm going to eliminate these in favor of the pi's. Okay? The constraints are, well, from pi 0, again, I follow the same procedure, but I'm not going to go through it in detail, so you can check this. This is just like we did it in 2 plus 1. In 2 plus 1, we had a theory A wedge F, E wedge F. We didn't have the analog of an E wedge E. Because notice, you can only do the B wedge B in four dimensions, because B is a 2 form. So it's only in four dimensions that you get to add this B wedge B. But as far as where all the time derivatives are, it's just the same of what we did with the E wedge F. So it's just as in 2 plus 1. So there is a constraint that comes from varying A0, which preserves the pi 0 constraint, and that's the covariant derivative on the B. But the B raised is the pi, so there's something that looks like di pi I is equal to 0, and this is just like Gauss's law, so we'll call it Gauss's law. Then when you vary the B0 I to preserve that the momentum conjugate to them vanish, we get that F spatial pulled back into the spatial manifold is related to B. So I get some constraints I'm going to call Fi, which are two forms that say that Fi minus lambda Bi are equal to 0. Okay? And that's all the constraints there are. And the Poisson bracket, just to write out everything. Oh, but sorry, I forgot to say something. The B here that the spatial b is related to the pi. So this looks like fij minus lambda epsilon ij k pi k I is equal to 0. And the Poisson brackets are ai of x pi j j of y delta 3 x y sorry, put the indices the wrong way. J, J, delta I, J, delta capital I, J. Okay? So that just says that the pi is a conjugate to the a's. Okay. Any questions? Comments? Now, have we seen this before? They may have a memory thing. Goes back to the first class. We have seen this before. And this was the equation that led us to De Sitter spacetime in the context of his general relativity. And this was, I call this the self-dual condition. So, and I you don't have to go back and look, we'll bring that back. We'll return to that. That was a kind of prelude to that lecture. Okay, but we have seen exactly these equations before. Before, these were a solution to the equations for general relativity. Now these are the whole theory. Now, I promised you some solutions to this theory. Okay? And since we're in Hamiltonian language, I will solve it with Hamilton-Jacobi theory. Does everybody sort of remember how Hamilton-Jacobi theory goes? Should I just review? So the basic idea of Hamilton-Jacobi theory. So let's suppose that I want to solve a theory where the Hamiltonian is 1 over 2 m p squared plus some potential v as a function of x. Okay. How do I solve it with Hamilton-Jacobi theory? I imagine that on the configuration space, which is the space of the x's, there is some function s of x, which we call a Hamilton-Jacobi function. And I require that the momentum, pi, be the derivative of the Hamilton-Jacobi function. And be its spatial derivative. And generally, I require that the energy be related to the time derivative of the Hamilton-Jacobi function. And that could be written covariantly in a nice way. And then I rewrite this as s dot equals 1 over 2m derivative of s squared plus v. And I now have an equation to solve in a single function s, which is a function generally of x and t. And that's how I, roughly speaking, use Hamilton-Jacobi methods to solve, to find solutions to Hamiltons, to equations in Hamiltonian form. Okay? So let's do that here. So the configuration space is, which I'll call C, is the space of the A's on the spatial manifold sigma. And I want to find a function of the a's. And I want to assume that pi I is, now it has to be the variational derivative of that function, which is a function of the a's and the a i's. And I plug that in to the constraints. Now, there's no time here, right? And this is related, if we remember, this was the same as in 2 plus 1. If I write the Hamiltonian, it's a function of sigma of some Lagrange multiplier times g plus some other Lagrange multiplier times f. This is just like it was before. So there's no time, for the same reason that there was no time in the Barrow-Bertoldi theory and so forth. So we're just trying to solve constraint equations. And so the equations that I should solve are the g becomes an equation for s that says that del I, the covariant derivative of the variation of s by a, is equal to 0. And the other equation I want to solve is that lambda times epsilon ijk times delta s delta a k is equal to f ij. That's the other equation I want to solve. So I want to find an s that satisfies those two equations. Does anybody know of one? Can you join a hint? It's on the blackboard. Anybody?
Well, this is usually the action. Yes.
What? Yes, but which action? So it's an action which is a function of a gauge field on a three-manifold. And it's function just of a gauge field on a three-manifold. So the transignment's action. Yes, so the solution is that the Hamilton-Jacobi function, okay, is equal to some constant times the transignment action, okay, where I put that k there, and we can work out what the k is, and we see that the k is 1 over lambda. There's some numerical fact. I could have set up the normalization differently, but let me just leave it there. Okay. So that's the solution. So what this says is that if I'm on the space, which is an infinite dimensional space, the space of connections, on this three-manifold, okay, there's a function which is the Chern-Simon invariant. And if I flow, okay, along the gradient of the Chern-Simon's invariant, why do I flow? Because A dot is like pi, which is like the gradient of the Hamilton-Jacobi function. So if I flow along the gradient of the Chern-Simons action, the Chern-Simons invariant, then I get a solution of those equations in four dimensions. Okay? So the Chern-Simons invariant is a Hamilton-Jacobi function for this theory. And these are the equations. And by the way, there are no other solutions. So this is it. This is the solution. It's not even, I mean, you can, somebody has a proof that there are no other solutions, please come and present it. But there are, as far as I know, there are no other solutions. And I think that, I think I know why. Because it's a topological field theory and it doesn't have an infinite number of solutions. And there's something actually that's even more cool, which is that since you flow along, so a given, this is the configuration space, and a classical solution is a trajectory in the configuration space. So this trajectory corresponds to a four-dimensional history, where each point here is a three-manifold with some Chern-Simon invariant.
So I have a question. Normally in the Hamilton-Jacobi theory, that S is parameterized by initial values. So I mean, you because Newton's
sure.
So how could it just be one solution? On
I've ignored that. You're right.
The Chern-Simons action takes. It doesn't. It's not parameterized by initial values.
Yes, but you're going to be, something very interesting is going to happen. Okay, I mean, thanks and save that. Okay? Because we're going to see what freedom there is. Okay? And so the value of the Chern-Simons invariant, you can take as labeling the given slices as you evolve. So there is a time coordinate on the four-dimensional manifold that you get, which is equal to the Chern-Simons invariant. Okay. So the Chern-Simons invariant is deeply related to the dynamics of this theory.
So, sorry, yeah. Does that serve as a definition of time in this context?
It could. I don't want to make a philosophical discussion about the problem of time, but it's a natural choice that could be used.
I didn't understand this. So you have a sequence of three-dimensional manifold,
right?
And then you have a constant surface defined by.
So here's my sequence of three-dimensional manifolds.
Yeah.
Okay. There, since we're following the gradients,
yeah.
And I'm being sloppy, and I'm not worrying about there might be singular points or something like that, or branching points or something. Since you're following the gradient. For each point here, which corresponds to a three-dimensional gauge field, the Chern-Simon invariant is different.
So how did you get the call?
So now I imagine that I, let me fill in, okay, that I now have some four-manifold, okay. And if you like, the coordinates of a point in this four-manifold are some t and some yi, where the yi are coordinates on three-manifold. Okay? And I choose ai of y and t to be the ai of y for the slice labeled by t is the integral of the Chern-Simons invariant. And therefore I get a gauge field on a four-manifold. And I have to tell you its other coordinates, so I have to tell you what A0 is. But A0, I say, can be anything you like, since it's a Lagrange multiplier, and it doesn't come into the equations of motion. Yeah?
I'd say something silly, but so on each slide, you can do a little propagation transformation, so that the Chern-Simons actually scalary.
Yeah.
So if you are changing along the trajectory, it doesn't mean that you're, those points that you're connecting are related by large gauge transformations.
Very good. So if I make a large gauge transformation, if I start here,
Right.
Supposing that sigma is compact and has non-trivial pi 3, okay, and I make a large gauge transformation, okay, then that's going to take me to a point on a slice which differs by from 8 pi squared. So this is what I was saving, and thank you for it. Okay. So actually, there's an identification by 8 pi squared. So it's actually a cylinder. That is, if I start here, I go up to the same point on 8 pi squared. That would be true anywhere. So I come back. Okay. So I'm actually going around the cylinder. So there's a kind, so time is kind of naturally compact. That is, if I want this to be related, if I believe that a large gauge transformation is a physical equivalence, then I get an identification of every surface labeled by a Chern-Simon invariant with the surface of 8 pi squared greater than that. Okay? Because under a large gauge transformation, I change the value of the Chern-Simons invariant by increasing by 8 pi squared.
That's something that can be cut.
Yes. That was my property somewhere under, hidden under there. Okay? Now, that's a very beautiful property, and I'm not prepared to show it yet, but one of the places we're going is that that's why the Sitter space has entropy.
Sure.
That's particularly in the case with it. Well, it turns out you have something like it because if the gauge group is a Lie algebra bigger than SU2, it will have an SU2 subgroup. And you can actually play the game. Actually, you can play the game within every SU2 subgroup of a larger gauge group. But that's, I don't. Sorry, I'm doing a number of things today where I'm pointing towards the future.
I thought, you know, you need the periodicity in imaginary time.
Yeah, so far, this is imaginary. I haven't made the correspondence to general relativity yet, but this is imaginary time when I do.
Oh, okay, so it's actually just topologically that you say you have a time direction.
Yeah.
I haven't given you a metric.
So I haven't given you a metric, yes. Okay. This is not yet general relativity.
Are you distinguishing between three-dimensional gauge transformations and four-dimensional gauge transformations?
I'm only talking about three-dimensional gauge transformations.
So within three-dimensional gauge transformations, with the large gauge transformation, it's not actually numerical.
Yes.
In the case of compact.
Yes. That's a very beautiful and important property. And I didn't come prepared to show that. If you'd like to see it, I will try to remember to come prepared to show that next time. And that's a little bit of an intricate calculation, but I think I could cover it. Okay. I promised you two connections to Chern-Simon theory, and I'm gonna, if I can find the eraser, I'll do the other one, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and do general relativity. Okay. So, okay. What if I now put a boundary on this three-manifold? Okay. So my three-manifold will have a boundary, and let me just consider, it doesn't, I just have to give that a name. Anybody have, what's a good name for a boundary? Besides D, which is already there. R. I don't know. B, C, D. Delta of sigma. Yeah, maybe I'll just use delta of sigma 3. Okay, thank you. And I've lost the eraser again. Up here. 0. So that's, there's just a boundary not equal to 0. Okay? And let me go back through the functional differentiation. And now I have a problem. Because if I take the action, let's find the action again. There'll be a boundary term. So if I write delta of s, then there's a term in there which is b wedge the derivative of the variation of a on sigma. And if I integrate by parts to get the equation, which is here, wherever it was, here, if I integrate by parts to get the equation where the derivative goes on the pi, then there's going to be a boundary term, and the boundary term will be an integral on the boundary of sigma, this is an integral of sigma cross r, that's our four manifold, and so I have an integral on the boundary of sigma cross r, which is a three manifold, and I have b wedge delta a, which is a three form integrated over a three manifold. This was traced over in the SU2 indices, so it's still traced over in the SU2 indices, minus what I wanted, which was the derivative of b wedge delta of a on sigma cross r. So there's a boundary term. And I have to worry about the boundary term in defining the equations of motion. The reason is that when you're defining a variational principle, all the boundary terms have to vanish. Otherwise, you can't extract the equations of motion from the variation as local equations, because you have this term that exists only on the boundary. Okay? There are three ways to solve the boundary problem. That implies that it's like a differential equation, to deal with the boundary term. Okay? Two of them are readily apparent. So we want to make this vanish. Okay, so one way is delta A on the boundary is 0. That would work. Another way is B on the boundary is 0. That would also make this term 0. But there's a third way, which turns out to be extremely interesting. And the third way is that you add a boundary action. So you add to S plus a boundary action, which is just a function of the boundaries, of the fields on the boundary, including A. So this is some three form, which depends on A and B. And if I do this, let me just call this three form rho, then what I'm going to get in place of here, then delta S total has a boundary term which is delta A, I'll just write it schematically, times B plus the variation of rho by A. Because there'll be a term with the variation of rho by A here. And there'll also be a term with delta B times the variation of rho by B. Okay, well, now there's two choices. Basically, there's no choice. Sorry, because look, if this boundary term could, in principle, depend on A and B on the boundary, but if it depends on B, then there's a term here. And then we've got a new thing, because it's proportional to delta B, which didn't exist before. There's no term in delta B that came from a boundary. So then we have to cancel this. And then it just, if you follow that, you just, it gets eventually to something inconsistent. So you can't make this a function of B. In that case, rho is a function of A only. And so we have to have a 3-form, which is well defined on the 3-manifold, which is the boundary, and has a nice equation of motion that comes with it. So the only real choice is that this is the Chern-Simons invariant of A on the boundary, where the boundary is a 3-manifold. And in that case, the equation is delta A times B plus F. Now, let me typically one actually puts a minus K over 4 pi here. And then it actually reads B minus K over 2 pi times F. And then you have to impose this. So then what you impose is that F minus 2 pi over K B evaluated on the boundary is equal to 0. And that's the third possibility.
So is the first term what actually comes from the integration by parts?
This is what comes from the integration by parts.
There should be minus and minus.
No.
It's where to, what do you mean there?
A dB is equal to D AB minus. There's no minus there. It's in the other term.
Is there a wedge in the bottom or not?
You should not trust me for science, but this is a 2-form, so you can flip the wedge through without changing the sign. You should trust me for signs generally, but I think I have this sign right.
And something else, I mean, normally this, the reason why you impose the first condition, you just say the variations on the boundary are 0, is that actually these boundary terms are very important when you drive stress energy densities and charges and so on.
Yeah.
So you're throwing all that out of the window by doing this trick, not imposing that condition or not.
No. The situation is that there are three kinds of cases you can consider, okay, with the three kinds of boundary terms. And in each of them, one is going to want to discuss what are the charges, what are the conserved quantities, and so forth. And they're different in the three of them. They are different.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, it may be that you may think that I'm jumping ahead, but what I'm doing is preparing the ground. Because this is a simple theory. As I said, I solved this theory. Okay? Without the boundary, I solved it, and with the boundary, you could still solve it. I'm not going to do it right now. So this is a very simple theory, and I just want everybody to see the structure of this theory because it's very simple. Because the point is that general relativity has a dynamical structure which is very closely related to this theory. And so general relativity has several of the same features of this theory, but it's more intricate because there are local degrees of freedom, whereas in this theory, there are no local degrees of freedom. And I haven't done the exercise to count the degrees of freedom, but one could do the very same exercise we did in 2 plus 1 and find what the degrees of freedom are. And they're the same, the degrees of freedom are the same integrals over quantities, et cetera. But I'm postponing that because I don't want people to fall asleep from boredom because it's just like what we did before.
So this is deliberately a new way of setting up actual degrees of freedom. It's not, you know, normally, you know, the way you treat the surface term is actually part of the whole principle.
Yes. Yes. That's yes. I don't know that it's new, but it turns out to be very useful to consider variational principles with explicit surface terms. Not only here.
Generally need them to make the variation principle in a sense of
right.
Gibbons Hawking term, for
instance. Yes, and the Gibbons Hawking term is hidden in what I've written. So that is it's related to this.
It's another sense.
Yeah, so this is the constraint pulled back to the boundary. So that's a nice consistency.
So you get the same solution as in the no boundary.
Yes. And the solutions are now labeled by data on the boundary. So there are more solutions related to boundary degrees of freedom. Because now I don't have to fix B to vanish. I don't have to fix the variation of A to vanish. I just have to fix that there's a relationship between F and its conjugate momenta at the boundary. It's a little bit more intricate than that because once I add this action principle, there's a time derivative here in the boundary term. So it's a little bit subtler than what you're thinking. And I hope my pedagogical method is okay. I'm trying to give you tastes of things and then plunge in. Okay, so there are some technicalities in making good on what I just said, but roughly what you said is right. That the same solution extends to the boundary, and the solutions are then labeled by information that you can extract by doing integrals on the boundary. And you do have degrees of freedom explicitly on the boundary.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. If we have such a manageable boundary, then we don't have the pi squared.
Yes, that's true. Then it's no longer a compact. That's clear. Okay, other questions? Okay, so I think what we'll do when we come back is general relativity and the punchline, the reason why we've set this whole thing up this way is to go back to this theory, is that general relativity is very closely related to that theory. And actually, it is related to that theory. There are several different ways to show it. And I'll do one when I come back. And then probably the other one, another very interesting one later on. Okay, so why don't we take a 15-minute break, and it's come back. It's at 8:15 by that time.